Welcome, comrades. Just before we start, I just want to do, thank you. I want to acknowledge that we're meeting on Aboriginal land, land that's never been ceded, the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I want to pay my respects to elders past and present, as well as any other Aboriginal people here today. So thank you for coming. Now, this talk is kind of jam-packed. I'm hoping I'm not going to overwhelm you because there's just so much to talk about and it's so fascinating. So I'm going to try and keep it, if I can, my talking to about 40 minutes, but I've got about 5 to 8 minutes, maybe 10 minutes of video as well. So please bear with me. I'm going to hopefully be able to work both these and that at the same time. All right, so let's make a start. Oh, and please forgive my, I'm sure I'm going to butcher the both Russian and Korean names. So my apology to anybody who speaks Russian and Korean and knows how they should actually be pronounced. All right, so let's, how do I start this? Okay, here we go. All right, so in 1918, the Russian Far East was plunged into a bloody civil war as Bolshevik forces fought to defend the revolution against the onslaught of anti-communist forces, backed by 9 imperialist countries, including the United States, Britain, and Japan. The brutality of the civil war was amply demonstrated when Khabarovsk in the Russian Far East was overrun by Japanese forces on the 5th of September 1918. After seizing the city, the Japanese Imperial forces arrested and executed the Bolshevik leadership in that city. Among those executed was Alexandra Stanikovich. Born Kim Aram and known as Alexandra Kim, she was a leading Bolshevik and the first Korean to be recognised as a communist activist. Here we go. All right, so this gives you an idea of where we are. So hopefully you can see where Moscow is and you can see where the Far East is. So it's a long way away. So born in a small village in Siberia, which was a hotbed of Korean nationalism at the time, her father would die in 1895 while fighting as part of the Korean independence forces against Japan. At age 10, Kim would be taken in by her father's comrades, the Stanovich family. After graduating college, she became a primary school teacher and married the son of the family that had taken her in. However, at the age of 30, in 1915, she left her husband and moved to Vladivostok to become politically active in the labour movement and join the socialist underground. And in 1916, she joined the Bolsheviks faction of the RSDLP. After the October Revolution, Kim was appointed the commissaire of the Far East Department of the Bolshevik Party by Lenin, and she was fluent in Russian, Mandarin, and Korean. And Lenin sent Kim back to Siberia to mobilise Koreans against the counter-revolutionary forces. Approximately 8,000 Koreans joined the Red Army, with this translating into 1 in every 4 able-bodied males joining. So that's actually a huge amount. And the key reasons why they joined the Red Army were, one, that most Koreans were tenant farmers who faced serious discrimination. So the Bolshevik slogans of, you know, land, bread and peace and land to the farmers resonated with them. Koreans faced discrimination under the Tsarist regime and the Bolsheviks promised an end to racial discrimination. In the Russian Far East, the anti-communist forces were supported and supplied by Japan, with Imperial Japan using its colony in Korea as a staging base. At the time, most Korean intellectuals and nearly all politically active Koreans in the National Liberation Movement saw the Bolsheviks as a natural ally against Japanese imperialism. 4 months before her death in September 1918, Kim helped to found the Korean Communist Party, meeting with Korean independence fighters Yi Dong-hui and Kim Rip in Khabarovsk. The Korean People's Socialist Party was founded in April 28, 1918. When the white forces and their Japanese allies overran the city, Kim was captured and executed. She was executed on the 16th of September and told her captors, "I'm not afraid of death. Your days are numbered. You resemble a pack of dogs in a mourning house, and you will never overthrow communism. Your goal is a pipe dream. Kim's last word to her Japanese executioners were reportedly freedom and independence for Korea. So during the same period that Kim was in the Far East, Korean nationalists were also active against the Japanese colonial rule on the Korean Peninsula. Among the Korean radicals carrying out armed struggle was, let's see if we can get this right. Didn't get this. Unfortunately, you were supposed to only see one at a time, but I mucked it up when I did it. Let's see if I can get that right. Okay. So among the Korean radicals carrying out armed struggle was Yoon Hee-soon, who formed the first all-woman righteous army. Such armies had been in existence since the 16th century on the Korean Peninsula and were irregular guerrilla armies who fought against repeated Japanese invasion. At the time of the Japanese colonialism, around 60 known righteous armies were in existence. Yoon was married to the son of one of the commanders of a righteous army and originally tried to convince her father-in-law to fight with his forces, but she was refused. In 1907, she defied her father-in-law and formed the first all-woman righteous army made up of 30 women who she trained in fighting techniques. Yoon led her militia in attacks on Japanese military camps, freeing Korean prisoners and hiding them often in caves. While Yoon's militia was made up of women, she encouraged cooperation between her militia and the male-dominated militias to provide a stronger, more unified force to fight against Japanese imperialism and colonialism. Later in her life, she founded a school to train new independence fighters, continuing to support Korea's fight for independence until her death. I think she died in the mid-30s. The other person I wanted to speak quickly about, Yoon was by no means the only woman who joined the armed struggle. Nam Jae-hoon was also another woman who joined one of the revolutionary armed groups in Manchuria in the 1920s. What I thought was remarkable about her was that she joined at the age of 46, telling her adult son she aimed to make the world worth living in. As a sniper and a company commander, Nam was tasked with assassinating key Japanese political figures. However, she was arrested in 1933 and tortured for 6 months after a collaborator informed on her to the Japanese police. At the time, she was preparing to go and assassinate one of the Japanese ambassadors. And I will mention a few of these. If people are interested in Korean movies and things like that, there is a movie called Assassination. They don't use her name in it, but the female character in that is loosely based on her. So it's a great movie. Despite the harsh torture, Nam remained undaunted and staged a hunger strike for 15 days, but she would die not long after being released because of her weakened condition. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the Korean independence movement. So between 1919 and 1920, a liberal bourgeois independence movement against the Japanese colonisation inside Korea started to gain momentum, with more than 2 million Koreans from all walks of life, young and old, taking to the streets in more than 1,500 demonstrations over a six-week period. Protesters were beaten, arrested, tortured, murdered, and with more than 7,500 killed, 16,000 injured, and 46,000 people arrested by the Japanese colonial forces. Among those who risked their lives as part of the anti-colonial Samsel or Mansae movement, Mansae comes from the chant, which means long live Korea, which was very used at the time and is still used today in a lot of demonstrations in Korea, was Korean high school student Yoo Kwon-sun. Yoo joined the 1st of March protests with her fellow high school students and was arrested but later released. In the wake of the student protests, the colonial regime closed down all the Korean schools and Yoo returned to her hometown. Sorry, I should give you a picture of her. This is her arrest photo, by the way. So she returned to her hometown, secretly bringing with her a copy of the Declaration of Independence that had been read out at Pagoda Park during the protests. In Chonan, her hometown, she became a key organiser along with her brother and her father of the local movement. You toured the district, speaking with local villagers, schools, workers, churches, groups, convincing them to participate in the struggle. On the 1st of April, 4,000 workers, students and farmers mobilised in opposition to the Japanese occupation. They were attacked by the Japanese police who opened fire on them, killing 19, including Yu's mother and father. Yu was arrested and imprisoned. Undaunted, she used her trial to stage protests demanding Korean independence and an end to Japanese rule. Incarcerated in Sodaemun prison, Yu continued to organise. After months of torture, unfortunately, she died on the 28th of September 1920, just 2.5 months short of her 18th birthday. Her last words were defiant. Her only regret was that she wished she could have done more. So I'm going to show briefly, there's again a film, some of it for the older stuff, it was really hard to find films, actual proper footage. So I'm using some of the films that have been made. So the next film is a film that was made a couple of years ago called A Resistance, which Liz and I went and saw when it was here in Melbourne. And it's a fantastic film, which talks about basically Yu's time in prison. So I'm just going to see if I can play that.
この部屋で始まりました。
만세를 불러 감옥에서
최후의 일인까지 최후의 일각까지 떳떳하게 외쳐라.
왜 그렇게까지 하는 거요?
It is a bit of a harrowing film, but it is really worth seeing if you get a chance. Okay, so among the other women who were in prison with Yu was Kim Hyang Hwa, who had also participated in the who had also participated in the March 1st protest. Kim was a leader of the Gisandang, a pro-independence movement made up of Kisangs. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correct. The Kisangs are often described in flowery terms as highly trained courtesans. In reality, they were enslaved sex workers who were property of the state. In Korean Joseon society, social status was hereditary. And if your mother was a slave or a Kisang, then you were a slave or a Kisang. The status of Kisang was also doled out as a means of punishment with female relatives of the aristocracy who had committed crimes, often being condemned to a life of servitude and dishonour. Despite being of the slave caste, Kisangs had also rights that weren't afforded to other slaves. For example, they could own property and they could be paid for their services. And because of their role included providing artistic and entertainment and conversation, so it wasn't just sex work, it was other aspects of it, to the upper class, they were also highly educated, often better than women of the ruling class, whose primary role was to be homemakers who look after just their husband and children. The top picture there is of a Kisang school. Often their education would start very early, from the age of six or 10, and it mirrored that of the Yangban or aristocracy. Not only did they study things like etiquette, dance and music, but they also were educated in philosophy, history, medicine, and often could speak more than one language. This is just a depiction of them entertaining. Their involvement in the struggle for independence was unsurprising, as they had a long history of being politically active, including acting as spies and key sources of information for righteous armies, because often, you know, the ruling class would go there and get diplomats and they would get all the sort of information. What have I just done? Wrong one. Okay. So after the March 1st movement, the Korean anti-colonial nationalist movement developed rapidly, spreading throughout Korea and beyond. This nationalistic consciousness manifested in Manchuria through the armed struggle and within Korea through the efforts of the labour, farmer and youth movements. After Japan's 1910 annexation of the peninsula, the Korean working class expanded in both size and class consciousness. Between 1910 and 1945, the Korean population grew from 15 to 24 million. Korea was overwhelmingly an agrarian society, but it began to industrialise, mainly around mining and manufacturing. City dwelling dropped from 3%, went from 3% at the start of colonisation to 14% by the end of Japanese rule. Not only were peasants evicted from their lands and forced into factories, but the rapid boost in Japanese investment also resulted in an expanded working class. Between 1926 and 1931, the number of industrial clashes more than doubled, and the number of workers participating in them rose from just under 6,000 to more than 21,000. Inspired by the Russian Revolution and sobered by the lessons of the March 1st movement, communist circles throughout Korea began to fuse with the workers' movement. This changed the class balance, putting the politically conscious workers at the centre of the movement. As mentioned previously, the first Korean Socialist Party was formed by Kim Il-sung and other fellow independence fighters in 1919. By 1922, the party had nearly 7,000 members. So by the early 1920s, communism had become an important part of the discourse of anti-colonial resistance in Korea. The first domestic Korean Communist Party was established in Seoul in 1925. After constant surveillance, it was dissolved in 1928, forcing the activists underground into labour unions, factories, student groups and youth movements. In the early 1920s, there was a rising sentiment among the communist circles that there needed to be an umbrella organisation to allow cooperation with the March 1st nationalist camp. This led to the formation of Singhenho, or the New Trunk Association. It was founded in February 1927 and sought to unify different factions of the communist, socialist and nationalist factions. It remained the key organising group leading the anti-colonial struggle up until May 1932. And it had between 30 and 40,000 members and approximately 100 branches outside of Seoul. Its platform, among other things, called for an abolishment of racial, political and economic oppression, free speech, organisation, association and publishing, support for youth and women's equality, and the overturning of factionalism and clan nepotism. A parallel women's organisation, the was founded 3 months later in May 1927, combining classic liberal feminism with socialist class-orientated demands. ANU academic Ruth Barraclough, who has written on particularly on the factory girls during this period, and also on she has a book called Red Love, which is looks at sort of feminism and communism during this period. She says that in her book, Ruth Barraclough talks about how some of the best known communists at this time in the 1920s were actually women. Not only were they regarded as being notorious, they were also regarded as being glamorous. They frequented the social pages as well as the arrest notices in the daily newspapers. It's pretty cool, isn't it? I like that. Three of the most prominent women communists at the time were Ho Jong-suk, who is this person here, Vera Khan and Chung Chil-song. Unfortunately, and they all participated in the March 1st uprising. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a picture of Vera Khan, but she was a nurse who spent 1 month in prison after the Mansay demonstrations, and in the years that followed, she worked as a labour organiser among the women factory workers. In 1925, Khan and Ho Jong-suk, who was also a journalist, orator and labour organiser, formed the Korean Women's Society of Comrades, which was the first socialist feminist organisation in Korea. Among the women who also were part of the organisation was Chung Chil-song, one of the many Kisangs who had participated in the 1st of March demonstrations and later joined the Communist Party. She was also an author who wrote the very first women's magazine, and she called on the national movement to put at its centre the struggle of those, in particular women, who had nothing. Ruth Barakoff, as I mentioned, the ANU academic, notes that the period that followed the division of the Korean Peninsula, Khan, Ho and Chung have been reduced, as she puts it, to characters in the Cold War order that looked for an archetypal tale of perfidy and tragedy. In both Ho and Chung's cases, they joined the communist forces that fled to North Korea in the wake of the US military occupation of South Korea, which actively sought to suppress and jail communists. In North Korea, both women became prominent figures in the regime there. However, Chung was purged from the regime in 1958. In Khan's case, she went to the Soviet Union after she married in 1928, and in 1937, her and her husband were among the Korean communists who were arrested and purged during Stalin's 1937 to 1938 purges. I keep hitting the wrong button. Sorry, comrades. Okay. All right, I'll leave that there. Well, so you can read that as I'm talking. Hopefully you can do both things. So the 1933 platform of the Korean Communist Party in South Cholo, which is in the south of Korea, and by this stage they're underground, illustrates the struggle faced by female factory workers at the time, with the platform calling for the abolition of the repressive dormitory system, production-based wages and differing wages from and the equal wages for Japanese and Korean workers, as well as the adoption of an 8-hour workday for adults, a 6-hour workday for youths aged between 16 and 18, and the abolition of child labour, a paid holiday once a week. At that stage, I think they were only allowed a holiday, like a break, once a month, maternity leave and breaks for breastfeeding children, for breastfeeding mothers who are feeding children. So the dismal working conditions of female workers was further outlined here in this 1936 article, which I'm not going to read out, so I'm just going to leave that there for people to read through. So at the time, women working in the silk, cotton and weaving industries, as well as the rice and food processing factories, are often portrayed today as having little agency due to the oppressive system under which they laboured. This is not the case. And I'll give you an example of why. This is Kang Ju-rong, who was a prominent female labour activist. She worked in the Pyongyang rubber factory and emerged as a central figure in the labour protests during the 1930s. In 1931, Kang and 48 other women at the rubber factory were locked out. And in response, she climbed up onto the roof of the Ulmi Pavilion, which was apparently the biggest building in Pyongyang at the time, and staged the first ever rooftop sit-in, which lasted for 8 hours. She told the Japanese police, "I refuse to come down until the foreman of the rubber factory retracts his statement regarding wage cuts, and do not think that they will succeed in taking me down from here by force. I would rather fall and die, than have anyone take me and put a ladder against this roof." Kang's example of defiance would become a mainstay of South Korean protests in the second half of the century, with various different roof sit-ins and protests happening. And I did want to talk about, but because I've already got too much, I'm just going to very briefly mention Kang Kyong-ye, who was an independent communist sympathizer, but she's also recognized as one of the greatest writers from this period. Basically, she was based in Manchuria, and she wrote about basically the lives of the factory girls and the women in ordinary days life, and she was able to, you know, actually get a lot of socialist issues across without it being censored. She also reported on a number of uprisings and things like that. I meant to bring the book in with me, and I left it at home, but this has been translated a couple of years ago. It's as one of her key novels from Wanzo Pond. So if you're interested in reading any of her work, you can. All right, let's move on. Okay, so after the division of the Korean Peninsula, US imperialism imposed a 4-year military occupation in South Korea, which was not only contemptuous of everything Korean, but virulently anti-communist. Lieutenant General John Hodge actively sought to root out communist and labor activism. At the time in 1946, there'd been a poll done by the US revealed that 70% of Koreans supported socialism and 7% had supported communism. Hodge refused to work with the Korean independence activists who had established the Korean People's Republic and the Popular People's Committee, instead installing, according to one journalist, a motley assortment of expatriates, collaborators, fascist reactionaries, professional assassins, and confused intellectuals. Strikes were banned, the KPR and the People's Committees declared public enemies, their leaders arrested, demonstrations crushed, and the US puppet Syngman Rhee installed. So that's just to give you an idea of the division. It's along the 38th parallel. I've written an article on this in Red Flag, which discusses why that happened, if comrades want to check it out. So Rhee would continue the repression through the 1950s. So this is him there. And that's a picture of Rhee in the blue. And in the middle is Douglas MacArthur, the US general. And on the other side is John Hodge, the leader of the occupation in South Korea. So in April 1960, workers and students fed up with the depression and the corruption of the Rhee regime, staged what was now known as the April Revolution. Protests began when the discovery of the body of a high school student, Kim Joo-yul, who had been killed in a march protest against the rigged elections. In an attempt to suppress the protests, another 186 protesters were killed by Rhee's forces. On the 26th of January, 2 weeks after the protests began, Rhee resigned and fled the country. The student and workers' victories, however, was very short-lived. Just over a year later, Park Chung-hee launched a military coup d'etat against the Second Republic government. This is him at the time of the coup in the middle at the forefront. Park's coup was backed by the US government, both militarily and financially. His regime sought to rapidly industrialize and develop South Korea's economically through a combination of dysfunctional economic shock therapies and mass repression. His favorite tool of repression and the primary architect of South Korea's development state was the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. It was modeled, of course, on the CIA, but had far more reach than even the American one. It was established with the help of the US CIA, but it instituted a reign of terror and censorship. Not only did it take control of government planning, advising, and inspecting government bureaucracy, it was in charge of recruiting and hiring government bureaucrats and technocrats. It oversaw the sponsorship of businesses, corporate development, and government legislation. The role of the Korean CIA was to eliminate any obstacles in the way of the military junta, politically, economically, or socially. I did a talk a couple of years ago on the Gwangju Uprising, which I talk more about Park's regime in that, if comrades want to check that out. So now I'm going to talk about the workers during this period. Of all the workers being squeezed by Park's drive to build the economy, none were more exploited than the female textile workers. 20,000 girls aged between 12 and 17 laboured 16 hours a day, 7 days a week in horrendous working conditions. Although the labour standard laws existed, which mandated an 8-hour workday, they were regularly ignored. While the industry was predominantly female, there were men working in the industry. And on the 30th of November 1970, worker Chun Tae-il, in a desperate attempt to draw attention to the plight of the textile workers, self-immolated, shouting, "Observe the labour standard laws," as he died. John's death, that's him there on the left, and this is his mother. His mother and sisters were also activists. His death had an enormous impact on the course of the labour struggle, as well as the anti-dictatorship movement in South Korea. In the aftermath of his death, dozens of night schools for workers were established to teach workers basic skills, not only reading and writing, but also politics, their rights as a worker, and how to organise within the working class. So I want to talk about two particular struggles that happened during this time. The women workers at the centre of the textile industry were both subject to exploitation as labourers and also to structural gender discrimination, receiving, for example, just 56% of the wage that their male counterparts received. And this was, you know, done on the pretext that supposedly they were secondary earners. Thank you. When in 1972 women textile workers voted out the male chair of the Dong Il Textile Labour Union, basically the unions were centred around each of the companies and factories, so it wasn't like necessarily at the time. There were broader unions, but often each workplace had its own union. And they elected a woman leader for the first time in the history of the Korean labour movement. They were met with a campaign to undermine the new leadership. The campaign was no more evident than during the 1976 union leadership election. Before the election, female workers who were standing for election were beaten by their class collaborationist male co-workers, and the company also bribed police and to investigate independent-minded unionists and leaders involved in the company, in the workforce. When the election day arrived, pro-management workers nailed the doors of the residential dormitory shut to prevent female workers from voting. The women were able to smash down the door and stage a sit-in strike. In response, the company and class collaborationist workers barricaded the toilet shut, cut water supplies and electricity supplies, and this only resulted in the number of women growing from 200 to 400. On the third day, the government riot squads were sent in to try and break up the sit-in. What pictures have I got here? Seeking to prevent the attack, many women disrobed. I love this story. Seeking to prevent the attack, many women disrobed to their underwear, thinking that, you know, this would stop them being attacked because the cops wouldn't know what to do. And apparently they sang union songs while twirling their clothing around their heads, which I think is just such a great sight. The tactic initially did stop the police, who didn't know how to handle the women, but they soon started clubbing and arresting them. All up, 72 women were arrested, 50 of them had lost consciousness after being assaulted, 14 were hospitalised, and two women were so traumatised that they were put into a basically mental health institution for about 6 months. The workers, however, succeeded the following year in electing their fellow female textile worker, Lee Cheong-duk. But 10 months later, the Korean CIA formed an organised action squad within the National Textile Workers Union in order to suppress what they saw as a problem union. So this picture that you can see here, this is of this incident. Female union members had human excrement plastered on their faces, breasts, and in their mouths when they attended a general assembly meeting. Basically, they were very badly assaulted. Days later, Lee and the leadership, her leadership of the Dong Il Textile Labour Factory were expelled from the broader NTWU. Lee and her fellow activists, this is a quote. This quote here is basically her talking about what the conditions in the factory was like when she first joined. Lee and her fellow unionists continued to fight, staging hunger strikes and public protests, despite being beaten, arrested and accused of being North Korean agents. They, along with hundreds of other women, lost their jobs and were blacklisted and prevented from working in other places. Despite their losses, their struggles continued to contribute to the building of the South Korean radical trade union movement and laid the ground for other labour struggles that were to follow, including the next one, which is the YH strike. So YH was a wig company, and they had 4,000 women working there, and they threatened to close down and relocate overseas rather than accede to the women's demand for increased wages. So in response, the women went on strike, and the company, again, similar to what happened with the earlier strike, shut off water and electricity to the workers' dormitories. The protest was subsequently moved outside the New Democratic Party, which was the opposition party at the time, hoping to generate more public support. On the third day of the protest, again, the Park regime dispatched more than 2,000 riot police to forcibly evict the protesters. Police beat the protesters, the NDP representatives and journalists. Leaders of the YH union were arrested, and 21-year-old Kim Kyong-soo, who was also a member of the union committee, was killed. While none of the workers' demands were met, the police cracked down, and the following ousting of the opposition leader Kim Yong-sang of the NDP served as a catalyst for subsequent protests such as the Busan Masan movement, which put widespread pressure on the Park regime. It actually then caused massive division inside the Park regime, and this would lead to the assassination of Park by the head of his own CIA just 3 months later. So it's the quote up the top, that's from the leader of the union, and she's quick to say the women workers brought down the Yushin regime. Yushin was the name of Park's regime from 1972 to 1979. It was centred around the constitution, which he basically changed to suit him, to keep him in power forever. And Yushin means renewal or renovation. So the struggle in this period is known as the struggle against the Yushin. Okay, oops, getting there. All right, what's this picture of? Oh, Gwangju. Okay, so the democratic space opened up by the Park's death, however, was again short-lived. 17 days this time after Park's assassination, General Chung Do-han seized control through another military coup. As the democracy movement was repressed in Seoul by Chun's junta, the democratization struggle moved to Gwangju in the south, again in South Jeolla. To Gwangju, which is a city which was predominantly working class. There's about 700,000 residents, and about 70 or 80% of the residents were working class. The Gwangju uprising became a watershed event for South Korean society when student protests developed into a citywide rebellion that was later brutally crushed by the government troops. For 10 days, from 18th to the 27th of May, the working class of Gwangju defied Chun's military junta. For five of those days, the city was a liberated zone under the collective control of the people. And it's really quite amazing what they did. And again, another book I meant to bring in and I forgot. It's a novel, but it is written by a Korean novelist from Gwangju. And it's based on basically the events there, which is very good. It's called Human Acts by Han Kang. So I really highly recommend it'll make you cry. I think I cried in every chapter of it. But it's a great book. All right. So although the Gwangju uprising ended in bloody defeat with 20,000 troops storming the city, it became the driving force behind the South Korean pro-democracy movement through the 1980s, and it ushered in the next phase of working class popular struggle. This is actually about photos that we found later, like 40 years later, but this was the best imagery I could find. Ben, if you want to see some films that are based around these events, I highly recommend A Taxi Driver and this is one of the mass rallies. They had mass rallies during the liberated time, not just every day. Actually, two or three times they had mass rallies. I'm going to slip that finish and I'll start talking. So after Gwangju, for many intellectuals and students, Gwangju was a life-changing event, as it had been the workers and the lumpen proletariat who fought and died in the provincial building during the last stand against Chun's troops. Those who survived Gwangju were weighed down with immense shame and guilt. Along with the intensified brutality of the Chun regime, it resulted in a seismic shift in both the student and the workers' movement. Students started to smuggle in Marxist and anarcho-Marxist literature from Japan as well as North Korea to make sense of the world, and it led to a widespread debates about Korean capitalism and society. This led to a re-evaluation of their activities of the student movement and the intelligentsia in the 1970s and their lack of roots in the working class struggle. So, Oh, sorry, that's what I've just said, so you can just ignore that. and this this resulted in a strategy to build alliances between students, sorry, I've lost my face, students and the working class. Thousands of students became hakul, I don't know if that's pronounced, again, pronounced correctly, in the 1980s. Basically, these were just what was known as disguised workers. They began to enter factories as workers, making a conscious decision to join the working class struggle. It was basically illegal for them to do that. You had to change your documentation and your identity papers, and if you were caught, then you could be, you know, arrested, tortured, lots of new things. One of the disguised workers was 23-year-old student Kwon In-suk. This is a more recent photo of her. In July 6, 1986, the Korean Daily carried a one-sentence item at the bottom of the social page that Kwon had sued a detective, charging him with sexual torture during her recent detention. The small news item would rock Korean society for months. As part of the Undong Kwon, literally, which literally means the democratization movement sphere, Kwon's decision to go public with the charge of sexual abuse was unprecedented. She was only one of the estimated 3,000 to 10,000 worker students working clandestinely in the factories in the mid-80s. Like others, she had forged her identification card to obtain a factory job. In doing so, many of them, of the students who did this, endured torture, arrest, sexual assault, and even death. Kwon would become an emblematic figure, embodying the passion, the ideals, and the conflicting legacies of the 1980s movement. She's actually, last year, she was just elected to the Korean National Assembly. She's part of Moon Jae-in, the president's party. I don't know. She went back to school and became a feminist scholar, I heard, as well. So, all right, so we're almost at the end. We're getting there. Hopefully you guys aren't still finding this interesting. Okay, so now we're going to jump to the 87 uprising. This strategy adopted by the students, however, was instrumental in helping to organise and mobilise workers in 1987 as part of the June uprising, where millions marched for democracy. It was a 19-day uprising across the country against the Chun Doh-hwan regime, and it involved a broad coalition of forces. The driving force, however, with the workers and the students, who raised as a central slogan, "Remember Gwangju." So this, again, I found a lot of trouble. For some reason, you would think there'd be really good footage on 87, but there isn't. So this is not my favourite video, but it will at least give you a bit of an idea of what went on. The dissidents who tortured. Again, another movie which is really great if you're going to see it. It's called 1987 When the Day Comes, and the student they just showed you was about his torture and murder by the police, which was the catalyst of the protests. Almost finished. Okay, so in the post-Chun period, the legacy of the Under Kwon can be seen when 85% of the newly established National Council of Trade Union, the precursor to what is now the Korean Confederation of... actually, can we go past that one to the next one? I put it in just in case I had time, in the vain hope that we don't have time. That's it. Great. Terrific. Oh, don't want to start it yet. Yeah, great, thanks. So, yes, 85% of the new of the workers in the new Council of Trade Union actually came from the Labour student underground. Since 87, workers, socialists and left activists have still had to fight for their rights. Faced with neoliberalism and austerity, Korean workers have continued to face long hours, poor working conditions, increasing casualisation and job precariousness. Today in South Korea, women workers in particular, those working in the irregular part-time or casualised employment, are some of the most marginalised and least likely to be unionised. These women, however, over the last decade and a half, have sought to demand better wages, conditions and job security. One such example is the June 2007 struggle by the Eland workers. 600 mostly women workers employed by the supermarket chain took control of the company's largest store, launching their fight for job security and equality for irregular workers and against outsourcing. A week later, workers of another supermarket chain who were part of the same corporate group also took control of their largest store and made similar demands. The strike continued for 510 days, with workers taking over and occupying 22 stores nationally. In the end, the women won a guaranteed promotion to irregular employed workers who had exceeded 16 months of a working period, increases in wages, and also the 12 Eland protest leaders were released from jails. The video I've skipped, which I was going to show, was again another movie. It's called Cart. It's excellent, and basically it's a fictionalised account of this particular struggle around of the women, and you've seen it. We watched it. Yes, yes. Yeah, Liam will attest that it's good. All right, so I'm going to finish up now. We're right at the end. The radical and revolutionaries who I've discussed in this talk are not simply historical figures. Their actions and activities have lit the path for the struggles of the working class in South Korea, at least. I wanted to end this talk with the footage from the 2016 protests that brought down the South Korean presidency of Park Geun-hye. And if you weren't aware, Park Geun-hye was actually the daughter of Park Chung-hee, the dictator. And while she wasn't going to the extent he was, she was trying to bring in very many repressive issues. While the protests were in a very liberal framework, what they did show is that collective organising works and that the working class are the driving force for change within capitalism. So I'm going to see if I can... I wanted to try and fast forward in this, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to. I just have to watch the whole thing, sorry. I'll answer a couple of things, but I also will get Liam to contribute a little bit on the question of the left, where it is, since he was there recently, more recent, probably the most recent of all of us. But just quickly, on the left in general, I mean, the thing is, the whole boogeyman of North Korean spies is still really big in South Korea. You know, the left is constantly accused, rightly or wrongly, of being of being North Korean spies and all these sort of things. And even during Park's regime, there's a couple of articles in Red Flag that I've done. There was one I did on basically how the opposition party, the main opposition party, was dissolved and the leader was thrown into jail, basically because of the National Security Agency accusing them of, you know, being spies. So this is still going on today. So it's not, maybe it's not as bad as it was when Liz was there, but there's still, you know, elements of this. And even during the massive protests against Park, you know, there was a small section of supporters coming out having counter-protests, mainly older Koreans who had basically supported her father, Park Chung-hee. You know, again, basically blaming everything on that was happening, that it was all North Korean spies and this was a North Korean, you know, what's the name. So this is a real threat to the left there, and there's still laws in place that could end you up in jail if you identify as a communist and things like that. So it's one of those things that the radical left, revolutionary left, do need to be careful about. But I'll hand to Liam to say a bit more, and then I'll come back and just finish on the last couple of questions. So just to quickly finish up, so just on Savan's question about the disguised workers. So basically, you have in Korean society, basically everybody has an ID card, and that kind of denotes where you're at and things like that. And particularly during the period of the dictatorship, you had the two dictatorships. It was used as a way to, you know, try and divide people, keeping alliances from being built. So if you're a student, then you had a particular type of ID. If you're a worker, you had a particular type of ID. And so for students to go from the student realm into becoming an underground worker, it meant they had to forge their IDs. They had to change, they had to hide their education credentials, they had to do all of these things. So if they got caught, then they would be arrested, tortured, you know, whatever could happen to them. It was interesting when I was reading through some of the stories from some of the different disguised workers, and them talking about how, you know, a lot of them are students and intellectuals who've never done blue collar work in their entire life. I could imagine it would be, they've gone in and suddenly, you know, a lot of them are coming from middle class families, and they've grown in their families, come out of the Korean War with nothing. And this is why Park does still, both Parks had some support too, despite of how he did it. It was bringing, you know, the economy upwards. So this is why a lot of people still support this legacy of Park Chung-hai. So there's these families who suddenly, we've gotten moved away from being blue-collar workers and things like that. Why do you want to go back and do this? And so often they would have to defy their families as well. And it was seen as like, you know, we don't want our kids to go and do that. It's interesting reading some of the things. And Belle and other people are right. It's really hard, like, it was hard work finding a lot of the stuff that I wanted to find, and in English. I mean, there's obviously stuff in Korean, but I don't speak Korean, as you can tell from my butchered pronunciations. So it was hard, but, you know, you can find it if you look. Even with media stuff, I had to really, really trawl to find stuff. And even last night, finding the 87, I must have looked like, I don't know how many videos, but anyway, I got to the stage, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's enough. But I want to just finish on, Liam just mentioned to me too, and I did vaguely have a memory of it. Today marks the anniversary of the Jeju uprising, which happened in 1948 under the American occupation. And basically it was when they were, there was a big outcry against, them trying to push Syngman Rhee in. And so there was protests, and even among some of the military, they sided with the workers, and there was this big massive protest. Jeju is this island right down the south, and it was completely and utterly crushed, and all of the people were painted as, you know, communist sympathizers, agents of the north, all of these sort of things. So there's all of these histories that are still there. So I really encourage comrades, if they're interested, obviously that there's more to find out. You know, the easiest way to start is obviously, there's lots of historically based films, but there's some good books that are out there, some of the ones we've mentioned, that will start you off and looking that way, and then you can sort of branch out and find more. And comrades are more than welcome to contact me anytime. I don't know if I'll know the answer, but if I can, I will. So thanks so much for coming. I really hope you, I think you found it interesting, so thank you.